Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So Passover is just around the corner. It's coming up a little early this year, April 4th. So if you're looking to host a dinner party or just celebrate some everyday comfort foods from the Jewish cuisine sphere, it's actually a very large and vast sphere, and I've been learning all about it thanks to a new book that I'm holding right now. It's called Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen. The author, Leah Koenig, is in the studio. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining. Leah, you're such a longtime food writer. You've written for Sever, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. You also have your first cookbook, the Hasada Everyday Cookbook, which was also about contemporary Jewish cooking. So is that sort of your shtick?
Yeah, I would say, good use of the word shtick. I'm very impressed. I would say that, both of the books, but particularly this one, is really sort of just a reflection of how I cook, how I eat, mm-hmm. how I sort of engage with Jewish cuisine. And it really is trying to find putting one foot in the world of tradition and one foot in the world of where we are today and making them talk to each other.
Yeah, it definitely has your signature on it. I mean, you're obviously a person living in New York City. Mm-hmm. There's colorful green market produce throughout. So it kind of speaks to where we have come, I guess, with Jewish food.
Yeah, I mean, I think many different people, whether they're Jewish or Taiwanese or mm-hmm. Korean or Japanese or whatever, are really mining our own traditions and really sort of looking for the things that maybe a generation before us kind of brushed under the table or didn't really want to engage with.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I think it's something about being, third generation or fourth generation. And we have sort of a freedom to kind of explore and take on some of the things that maybe were embarrassing to our parents and grandparents' generation. I'm really close friends with the folks who run Gefilteria, which is a boutique artisanal mm-hmm. Jewish food company that makes gefilte fish, and it's really, really good. Mm-hmm. It bears in some ways complete resemblance to what your grandma maybe made, but in some ways is a totally different animal or fish, I guess.
So it's kind of re-embracing it with a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, is that it? So iconic for being hated.
Well, I think Jewish culture and Jewish tradition has such a element of humor to it. So there's definitely a tongue-in-cheek vibe. But on the other hand, I think there's so much to enjoy and to explore that is serious, not in a serious kind of way, but there's so much to explore that you almost don't even need the humor in some ways.
Yeah, I have to tell you, Leah, when I went to a Passover Seder at my neighbor friend's house when I was a little kid, I was the only one at the table who ate the gefilte fish because it reminded me of fish balls
that, oh my gosh, that's
from Chinese food.
That's hysterical. Literally all the other plates were just like scraped into the garbage?
Oh my gosh. The mom had to force feed people. Kids were crying. Like, there's tears.
Well, you know, the stuff, the jelly in a glass jar, kind of murky liquid hockey puck gefilte fish, I don't blame anybody for not wanting that.
But homemade fresh, like the gefilte fish. How's it go?
Gefilteria. They do an interesting thing in that they use other types of fish. They use some salmon and some other types of whitefish to kind of freshen it up. But they also have found different ways to cook it. And it, actually, in my book, usually gefilte fish is cooked in this kind of really stinky fish broth, which I personally
don't like.
I just can't hang with that. But so I used a white wine kind of court bouillon, which is an herb infused white wine broth. So it really is a much lighter and much more kind of fragrant and really lets the fish shine through without having that overpowering, heavy, like punch you in the face. Fish thing going on.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So this recipe looks beautiful. Your gefilte fish and white wine broth, white wine and herb broth is colorful. It looks like there's carrots studded throughout it.
Yeah, there's fresh herbs. There's lemon zest. Really, all the things that when you're cooking fish kind of help to brighten it up.
Freshen it up.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a really good take.
Thanks. You know, and that's the thing I was trying to sort of get at is one, you know, Jewish food kind of has this stigma around it of being really heavy and being really bland. And, I think every stereotype has a grain of truth in it. And some of the ways that Jewish food has been kind of manifested over the last half century or so, it kind of lived up to that. To that reputation, but I think there's ways to do it that are much fresher. And I also think that if you go beyond the Eastern European tradition to, you know, Sephardic or Middle Eastern Jewish food cuisines, there's so much more fresh produce and a focus on olive oil and a focus on brighter, fresher flavors that you really have quite a vibrant cuisine.
Right, because in America, we tend to think of Jewish food as Ashkenazi cuisine. Mm-hmm. That is just the majority of the folks who came over Ellis Island?
Between sort of 1850 to 1920 or so, you know, you had first the German Jews coming in the 1840s and 50s, and then you had Eastern European Jews coming en masse in the 1880s to 1920s, and they, you know, they're the ones who made Russian Daughters and kind of, you know, Zabar's and all the institutions that we think of when we think of Jewish food in this country. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's much, much broader.
Yeah, and your book incorporates them all. Like, right now I'm looking at a recipe for foule,
foule madames. I'm not going to pretend I am an expert in how you say everything, so.
But I've seen this, you know, in Middle Eastern and Lebanese, like, cuisines. It's you mentioned it's from Egyptian Jews, this particular recipe.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that's interesting about Jews is, you know, and the Jewish trajectory is that aside from Antarctica, there's probably a Jewish community in every part, every country.
How do you know there's none in Antarctica?
You know, I'm sure they have great Shabbat dinners in Antarctica. Very cold. But yeah, so Jewish tradition throughout time has kind of eaten the foods of its neighbors and then adapted that cuisine to kind of fit the needs of the kosher laws and of the Jewish holidays. Mm-hmm. And over time that has sort of, you know, grown into their own special take on it. So anywhere you look, there's interesting Jewish food to be.
That's true.
Mined. Yeah.
Yeah. What is like a quintessential dish from the Sephardic Jewish cuisine?
There's a lot of different ones. One of my favorites is, it's called chraimi. It's like a spicy tomato sauce that you poach fish in. There is a tilapia dish in the book that's very, very much inspired by chraimi. But you know, even Sephardic cuisine is sort of lumped together as sort of this one kind of big unit. But it's you know, the foods of Jews in Spain and in Morocco and in parts of South America. So there really is that it's such a broad category in itself. But that's one of my favorites.
So what was it like researching for all these different cuisines that, you know, you mentioned it's such a vast swath, and your particular family is from the Eastern European.
Yeah, I'm an Eastern European mutt.
Ashkenazi tradition. Yeah. So how did you find these recipes? And
I've been writing about Jewish food probably for the last 7 or 8 years, and it's over time, you know, you kind of get bored of the one focus that you have, and you kind of try to look for other things within the tradition. And so I cook in people's kitchens. I read a lot of books. One of my favorite experiences is, Ethiopian Jewish community is actually quite large. Most Ethiopian Jews now live in Israel, the vast majority. But, you know, for thousands of years, they lived there. Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So are you familiar with Dorawat, their chicken stew?
No.
It's okay. I wasn't really either. But it's a traditional chicken stew that's eaten across Ethiopia, mm-hmm. but that Ethiopian Jews kind of started to serve on Shabbat and serve it in their own kind of particular way. So mm-hmm. I got to cook with a woman who lives in Harlem now. Biji Barhani is her name. And she runs a Ethiopian Jewish cultural foundation in New York. And so she took me into her house, and we cooked, and
wow.
her kids were running underneath our feet, and it all felt very like familiar, but it also was something totally new to me.
Wow.
So it was
that's really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I imagine it would be hard to find outside of the home kitchens, you know, a lot of really authentic home-style dishes. I mean, we can all go to Katz's Deli. We can go to Gus's and Russ and Daughters.
And Gus and Russ.
Gus's. You can all go to Gus, Russ, and whatever. But, you know, there's like these traditional kind of long-standing, I guess, what do you call it? Just like institutions
sure.
to Ashkenazi cuisine in New York particularly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But do we see examples of other?
Yeah. I mean, if you go to Los Angeles, there's a huge Persian Jewish community. So mm-hmm. there will be, you know, restaurants out there that kind of speak to that. Here in New York, one of my favorite examples is the Bukharian Jews who live in Regal Park, Queens. Mm-hmm. The Bukharian Jews are the Jews of Central Asia, so they are kind of like Tashkent and kind of near Mongolia. So like their food is really, it was traditionally from like thousands of years ago Persian,
okay,
and then has all of these sort of Silk Road influences.
Wow.
So you've got China, you've got Mongolia, you've got some India that kind of crept in there, because of all the people that kind of moved in and out through where they lived. And now all those Jews have moved either to Israel or to Regal Park, Queens. There's tens of thousands of Bukharian Jews there, and they have great restaurants. So, you know, when I first moved here, I had never heard of Bukharian Jews growing up in Chicago where I did. And you know, my friend took me to this restaurant, and it was amazing and just so flavorful and so different. But again, had that thread of something that felt really familiar.
Wow, that is really exciting.
So yeah, there are. You have to look a lot harder.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
But they are there.
And tell me more about like this kind of new wave appreciation for, I guess, rediscovering Jewish food in America. Because you kind of note that, you know, within the last 10 years, we've seen a drastic change in perception.
Totally. Yeah, I think that goes back to a little bit what we were talking about before, where, well, or Maya Lend, or, you know, mm-hmm. Why Sons Deli out in San Francisco, or Kaplansky's in Toronto. I mean, there's people who are sort of saying, hey, you know, these foods are ours, and they're interesting, and you know, I don't have to kind of keep them in a time capsule. I can actually bring who I am to these foods. And what you're seeing is just this kind of amazing flowering or whatever of nouveau Jewish cuisine. And I think, you know, people are really connecting to it, even both Jews and people who don't come from that background, because the food's just really delicious.
Yeah. And it's really grabbing everyone's attention and in a lot of exciting ways.
Yeah. I feel like every other day there's like a new Jewish food truck popping up somewhere.
Yeah.
Or a new bagel company, or, you know, we've got Black Seed Bagels here, and there's bagel shops out, and there's one in Detroit, the Detroit Bagel Institute, that's doing
people
it.
People are
so
geeking out.
They're totally geeking out. And it's so cool, because we still, you know, a lot of us still have grandparents who either speak Yiddish or,
right.
you know, who kind of grew up with these foods very much central to who they, you know, to who they are, and rejected them. And I think they're really touched to see that we're actually like excited to.
Right. That is really cool.
Yeah.
And I like how you note in talking about this exciting, you know, sea change of cooking in Jewish cuisine. You also write, historically speaking, Jewish cooking has had a tendency to focus on the past, to yearn for what was, hold tightly to tradition, and strive to capture times gone by through food.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that, you think? I'm going to play ignorant white person right now. Why is that?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the Jewish tradition is, the word tradition is so central mm-hmm. to who the Jewish people are. And because they've lived everywhere, they have to cling to something to feel rooted. And, you know, when they're traveling all throughout the world or being kicked out of places or yes. however the case may be. So I think whether it's, you know, connecting to the textual tradition or connecting to culture, be it music or food, there is sort of this very kind of tight, almost protective quality towards
culture,
Jewish culture.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, here, especially in the States, where we are much more kind of free, open, boundaryless society, mm-hmm. we are able to kind of relax a little bit.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's so exciting. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be back chatting more.
Sounds good.
You are listening to Wild Hearts by Remy de la Roque. This is Eat Your Words on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Washing my heart in you, I rise like a mushroom, an atomic cloud, a burning circle of life. No one, no one, no one seems to notice. Yeah, you fast cars. Yeah, you bright lights. Yeah, you wild hearts. Yeah, yeah. Changing speeds, the tires cry. Now I see why you make me ride an open road in the frenzy night. The moon in your eyes, to my surprise.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hola, I'm Daisy Martinez, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, we're back chatting more with Leah Koenig, the author of Modern Jewish Cooking. All right, so I love how you describe, Leah, that you were getting into perfecting your own takes on dishes through dinner parties with friends, mm-hmm. or just like inviting friends over and making something like bagels from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
That is so exciting. Can you tell me a little bit about like some of your highlights of things gone right?
Sure. Or adventures in Jewish DIY.
Yes.
You know, one of my favorite stories is, you know, my husband and I have people over for Shabbat dinner, you know, pretty regularly, or we go out to people's homes for dinner. And
that's
it's
awesome.
Yeah, it's always just like, it's basically an excuse to throw a dinner party every week. So mm-hmm. that's fun. But one of my favorite examples is there's a Jewish holiday called Shavuot, which happens in the spring, mm-hmm. about a month and a half or so after Passover.
Okay.
And the focus of that holiday culinarily is dairy foods. So, you know, you have a lot of cheesecake, and plinces is a big thing.
Yum.
And so I had a friend, my friend Avi, who invited probably like 15 or 20 people over to make blintzes at his house. And this was maybe like 10 years ago. I'm not old enough for it to be 15 years ago. But we realized that none of us had actually made blintzes before. And we just sort of like had at it and
okay.
just were like swirling the pan and trying to get our crepes right. And, you know, we had all brought like various random things to put in it. Like traditionally you use farmer's cheese or you use potato, but we had like dulce de leche, and we had like, you know, someone made like a strawberry rhubarb compote. And so we just sort of like winged it, and it was so much fun. We had a great time.
Modern blintzes.
Yeah,
pesto and chutney.
I think we had some pesto. There may have been some chutney. I don't remember anymore, but you know, it was really just it was fun, and it felt culturally relevant, and it felt open, and it was
And I bet it was delicious.
It was. It was. You know, since then, my Blintz crepe making has gotten a little bit, I've perfected it a little bit, but it was still a good time.
So tell me, Leah, how does one launch a Passover Seder in a way that feels authentic to them? Maybe they're, you know, young, they're living and hosting for the first time rather than going to their parents. Like, how should we do this?
You know, Passover is such a important holiday for people to get right. You know, it's like Thanksgiving dinner, and that people really expect certain things to be on the table. So of all Jewish holidays, Passover is the hardest one to kind of get a little crazy with, because if like there's no matzo ball soup on the table, people like will, you know, throw a fit.
Oh no, you want that.
It's really trying to find a way to update the classic. So the gefilte fish that we talked about earlier is a great example. You know, I have a recipe in the cookbook for jalapeno shallot matzo balls.
Oh, that looks awesome.
Yeah, and you know, on the one hand, like my grandma probably would, you know, roll over in her grave if she knew I was doing that. But the basic recipe is actually just a good solid matzo ball that you add some softened shallots and some cooked jalapeno to, and it really just brightens things up, and it without kind of changing it so drastically that you don't know what holiday you're talking about.
So it's not
about
this like uniform homogenous ball. It has like some
some fresh produce, some spiciness. Yeah. So I really think it's finding ways to kind of tweak the familiar. You know, I also am a big, I'm not the most Martha Stewart crafty person in the world, but I really think that decor is a big deal when you're holding a Passover Seder. So, you know, I kind of want to throw all of the kind of old school silver Judaica, like kiddish cups and candlesticks off the table. And you know, not the like pristine white tablecloth, and you know, maybe kind of have more of like a tapestry and like little mason jars of flowers and things that kind of just feel much more modern.
So rather than that weird gilded silver platter with the bitter herbs that you dip into cups, maybe like make a little arrangement.
Exactly, right.
A bouquet of herbs that people can grab.
The modern day Seder plate. Right, exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds like a fun activity. Do you have any plans coming up for your Seder?
Yeah, I mean, we go to my in-laws, who throw a wonderful Seder every year, and they live down in D.C. So I'm not at the stage of my life where I'm hosting Seders yet. But, you know, what I try to do is I bring foods that we can eat during the non-Seder time. So one of my favorite examples from the cookbook is there's a matzah granola in there.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, breakfast is really hard on Passover, because basically everything you want to eat for breakfast, you can't.
With leavened
Yeah,
stuff.
It's like bagels, you can't, waffles, you can't, pancakes, you know, oatmeal even is not okay.
Really?
Yeah. I've kind of developed this matzah granola. It's not completely my idea, but I made this really good one with coconut and walnuts and raisins, and it's really quite good. And you eat it over yogurt, and you almost don't remember.
That sounds great.
Yeah, you can kind of snack on it over the course of the holiday and
keep kind you of, energized.
Yeah, it gets you through.
Well, that's really inventive.
And I always say it's not necessarily the thing that I would run to the rest of the year, but during the holiday, it's kind of a godsend.
Sure. Speaking of inventiveness, I love how you managed to make a lasagna. It looks like, when you're just looking at this photo of the casserole of lasagna, it looks totally just like a lasagna, but actually it's made with matzah.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that?
Well, matzah lasagna, I can't claim to have invented it, but it's something that in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, you've really started to see a lot more of. And it comes out of I guess just desire to, you know, eat well during the holiday. It's like, you know, you are kind of, the holiday is focused on not eating certain things, and that kind of has meaning to it, but it doesn't mean you have to suffer through the whole holiday. So this lasagna is basically a standard spinach lasagna that you sub out matzah that you kind of soak in water a little bit so it softens, and then it takes the place of noodles. And I mean, it's pretty good. It's pretty good, I have to say.
So it's like familiar too. So it sounds like, you know, while you're eating during the holiday, you also have cravings for those same familiar American foods that are
sure.
A lot of them are hands off.
Yeah, you know, I was a vegetarian for 10 years, and during that time, You know, you kind of learn which dishes that you just can't live without, and you have to find ways to mm-hmm. to recreate them. And yeah. I think lasagna is a really good example of that.
I see.
You know, also on Passover, you're often feeding a crowd, so you want, you know, a good kind of solid casserole to do that. Although I have to say, recently, in the last couple of years, quinoa has been certified kosher for Passover,
which is talking a whole lot about quinoa on Heritage Radio.
I'm not surprised. but it's been such an amazing kind of game changer.
Really?
Because it's all of a sudden you have this grain-like, technically a seed, so it's mm-hmm. not, there's no problem with eating it, but this
sure.
grain-like substance that can really kind of
hey.
Serve as the base of a tabbouleh instead of bulgur, or it can kind of just, you know, you can mix with other herbs or other right. vegetables and make breakfast porridge out of it.
I love how the tradition of going without something has paved the way for all these discoveries and great foods that you can do
totally.
Even still.
Yeah, you have to get creative, for sure. For
so,
sure.
All right, so tell me a little bit about your kind of tweaks and ways that you have improved some of the classics. So there's a brisket recipe, mm-hmm. And you have red wine and honey in the braise.
Yeah, so that recipe actually comes from a meal that my husband and I had when we were on our honeymoon in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And we somehow, through a friend of a friend, got hooked up with like the premier kosher caterer of Rome for,
really?
For a Shabbat dinner, which, I mean, was just like the most phenomenal experience ever.
Mm.
And he served all of these traditional Roman Jewish dishes, and one of them Ooh. Was called stracotto,
okay.
Which is like a red wine kind of briskety type dish. So this was really my brisket was really inspired by that.
It looks delicious.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what braised meat isn't delicious?
Yeah. But when I saw the I thought it sounded a little French, but then the honey was like really interesting and kind of
yeah. Well, Jewish brisket tends to have some sweet element, so often it's like brown sugar or some they dump in a can of, like, you know. Some people use Coca-Cola. I mean,
really?
Just yeah. really kind of interesting.
Fruit, maybe yeah.
sometimes fruit, sometimes pineapple, or cranberry sauce.
Okay.
So I was kind of trying to go in that into that world, but honey to me just seemed like a fresh way to do it. And if you're serving it on Rosh Hashanah, where it's the apples and honey are kind of the main things that you eat on Rosh Hashanah, it's kind of a perfect way to kind of segue into that.
And by the way, I love how you describe things, because you're right. This, excuse me, this version of slow, this version slow cooks the meat in a sweet and tangy mixture of honey and red wine until it sighs and falls apart at the touch of a fork. That just like, that kind of melts my heart right there.
No pun intended.
Do you have any plans? I'm sure people ask you this all the time. Do you have any plans to launch a food business of some sort with all your expertise and, you know,
oh, thanks.
Recreating this food?
You know, I really consider myself to be, you know, a journalist who cooks mm-hmm. more than anything. And I love the exploration of, mm-hmm. I think I've said the word explore like 17 times because that's really what I like to do.
You're an explorer.
I'm an explorer, right. Yeah. I, you know, for me, it's really about digging into what's out there, and I can't imagine a better profession to do that than being a food writer. So I just feel really lucky to
awesome.
Get to do that.
Right on.
Yeah.
And what's next in the pipeline for projects?
Oh, it's a good question. Right now, I'm focused on marketing this book, mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm traveling to California, and I had a baby back last July,
Congrats.
So that's a big project right now.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah,
figuring on your plate.
Out. A lot of baby food activities going on right now, but I would love to write another cookbook, and I'm sort of just in the process of figuring out what it'll be.
Awesome. Yeah. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
So, Leah, you're going to be touring around Los Angeles. Where can we find your info, like leahkoenig.com?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, my website is a great place to check that all out. It's just leahkoenig.com.
All right. Check out the tour dates. And also, on March 23rd, Leah's going to return to the city. And
31st.
Oh, sorry. March, what did I say?
You said 23rd.
Oh, okay.
Which is my birthday, so I like that day. But March 31st.
So March 31st, we're going to be at Powerhouse Books talking, myself, that is, and Leah and author Louisa Shafia are going to be talking with journalist Beth Cracklauer about cooking your culture, discussing these books and hopefully many of the topics around them.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great.
So looking forward to that.
Me too.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Leah. It's been a pleasure having you. And everyone, check out Modern Jewish Cooking. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks.
The Eat Your Words theme song is Lovin' Like This by the California Honey Drops.
The way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.